Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on the mixed messages our culture gives us about being a girl.
You will train her harder than any Amazon before her. Five times harder. 10 times harder.
Never let your guard down. You expect the battle to be fair.
Until she is better than even you.
That's the sound of Wonder Woman in the making, and the sound of at least one Hollywood myth being blown up. Finally, Hollywood has long believed that women can't make and direct blockbuster action films. Why do you think so few women directors get the chance? Hollywood has also believed that girls won't buy tickets to action films if the star is a shero instead of a hero. Wrong again. As Deadline Hollywood recently reported, Wonder Woman is high box office sales, and it's because female audiences turned out, with women aged 25 and up leading the way. I bought a ticket to that movie. It was great. Karina Shikano writes about pop culture and feminism in her new book, and as she joins us, I'd like to hear from you. And here's something to think about. Do you think Hollywood has kept up with how we women are changing? Does Hollywood honor and reflect back our experiences and our empowerment? So when we look to Hollywood, or we look to popular culture, television as well, do we see reflected back about who we are as women? Love to have you join the discussion. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, and I tweeted out a question on this, and it's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Karina Shikano is a former film critic for the LA Times. She's a staff writer for Entertainment Weekly, and her new book is titled You Play the Girl, and she joins us this morning from LA. Where else? Karina, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you.
Let's talk about Wonder Woman in a minute, but I wanted to quote something that Patty Jenkins, the director, said about the big box office. She did an interview with USA Today, and she said, "I will not downplay it and say it was easy or that it wasn't an incredible task. But what's notable to me is that it's not that difficult of a task, and it's not that different for me to direct than anybody else." And of course, she's talking about me as a woman compared to a director as a man. What else is she really saying there?
Well, I think she's talking directly about this idea that's been so prevalent that women either can't direct these films or don't want to. And that's just something that's been said for so long.
And why? I mean, why is this? It's obviously a myth. Why has it taken it so long to knock it down in Hollywood? I mean, this is a fishbowl you're quite acquainted to with, and I'm not. So tell me, explain how to understand this.
Well, I think it may even be premature to say that we've knocked it down, because every few years there's a film that that seems to disprove this idea, either that women don't go to the movies or that female directors can't take on bigger projects. I think it's really a matter of the status quo and the way that the system works the way it works, and is slow to change and is unwilling to change.
I mean, so this is a good point, and this comes in from Twitter, and this is what I was thinking about. No, and our listener says, no way has Hollywood kept up, and they've missed great opportunities to make money. That's the thing that is puzzling about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been puzzling for a very long time. I mean, every time that there's a major box office success that where women are involved, it's still treated as a one-off or a fluke. And I just think that has a lot more to do with a way of thinking than it does with the reality.
You know, I was reading a San Diego study, you know, that I think every year it comes out from the Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film. And mm-hmm. and again, it shows, you know, there are, as you say, one step forward, three steps back. And I was wondering, I think you're alluding to the fact that there's inertia in this, but I also wondered, is it just rampant sexism? I mean, does that play a role in this?
I think so. I think that there's a kind of loop that happens. You know, at the top, the people who are making the decisions, it's a kind of a closed system, and the belief that, you know, that women can't do this kind of thing, or that men don't want to watch women, I think it reflects the attitudes of the people making the decisions, more than the average person.
So these are the executives who think, well, this is so because I believe it, and evidence to the contrary is not going to change my mind. Boy, we find that in politics and business and in a lot of other places in our culture, but also in Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely. I think we find it anywhere where there's money and power, and at the top is, you know, basically white and male, and just thinks a certain way.
I saw the Wonder Woman movie a couple weeks ago, and I was curious about what you think of the representation of Wonder Woman herself.
Well, I really enjoyed that movie. I thought it was a fantastic movie. I thought it was great for little girls to have that kind of hero. My daughter certainly loved it, saw it 4 times.
Wow.
Yeah, she just can't get enough of it. But I think there were a lot of great things about the representation of Wonder Woman. One of the things that I liked the most was that she seems to fight out of a sense of outrage at injustice, which I thought was very relatable and it gave her this amazing motivation that made me feel like all superheroes should be female because they kind of understand this more.
So, that's notable that you pulled that out. And I didn't think about that. That's why you're the film critic and I'm not. Because often it's superheroes fighting for what? Not a sense of injustice? I thought that's what drove most superheroes.
Well, I guess so, but they don't have the kind of skin in the game, I think, that Wonder Woman has implicitly. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're kind of coming in as saviors instead of as people that are coming up from that same sense of injustice, of fighting back, of feeling the injustice.
So when the UN chose Wonder Woman and then dropped her as their symbol of empowerment, we did a show on that. What did you think of that? I have to say I looked with some skepticism at the UN's decision, but now that I've seen the movie, I think I need to rethink that, maybe change my mind. What was your thought on it?
You mean you looked at it with you looked at the choice to include her or to drop her?
No, to include her. I didn't think of all the symbols that you could use for empowerment for so many different cultures, you know, where this is going to be seen. The actual representation of Wonder Woman, the skimpy clothes, the oversized, you know, all of that. I didn't think it fit, but now I don't know. What do
you
think?
Well, it's one, you know, I don't want to like lionize it to the point where I say that there's nothing left to talk about with this movie, because I think ultimately it still fits the mold and adheres to certain narratives that that require, for instance, that the heroine be dressed the way she's dressed or as beautiful as she is or whatever. So we still are beholden to these things, and we still should talk about those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, I'm with you. It's sort of mixed. It's kind of an easy message. It's kind of an easy symbol to choose, and at the same time, maybe not entirely the most empowering that you could choose. But but I think that she is. But I still think that she is a great symbol. I think little girls really respond to her. And
I was just going to grab a call here, Karina, from Grace in Columbia Heights. Hey, Grace. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. How are you thinking about it? It sounds like you saw Wonder Woman.
Yeah. So I haven't seen a movie in the theaters, I think, since like Avengers in 2010. And I love superhero movies. So I just went to go see Wonder Woman just because. And I actually have bought 2 tickets to it now because it was so impactful to me to see the representation of strong women on screen. I work in a field where I don't always get treated fairly or equally as a woman. And so to be able to see, you know, a woman, you know, the scene in No Man's Land when she, the men are saying, like, don't do it, it's too dangerous. And the woman, you know, Diana is, you know, she's independent. She's like, I'm doing this. And despite the men, she goes across and she saves the city. And I just didn't realize how impactful the representation of strong women on screen would be so impactful for me. I love it.
Yeah, really good to have your call. And they seemed, Karina, like they're leaving the door open for a sequel, or is that already a done deal?
Yeah, I think so. But I do think that I agree with that, with the caller, that she really is invested in fighting for people, and that I think people really responded to that.
You have an essay in your book called Girls Love Math. I want to talk about this too. In which you write, women in their teens, 20s, and 30s are 39% of the population, yet they comprise 71% of women on TV. And here's the infuriating fallacy of that. Lots of us who are long past our 30s, you're not, but I am, want to see women. You are too? No, you're not long past your 30s. We want to see women of our own experience and our own accomplishments and our own... our own age on television and in movies, and it seems like they consistently and deliberately ignore what the audience wants. You've thought this through. What conclusions have you come to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not just important for us. I think it's also important for younger women not to be told from the moment they're children that they're going to disappear, you know, from the landscape. By the age of 40, I think that the idea that you can't see a forward path for yourself narratively is a huge problem. Our whole lives, we're working towards something, and then the most common storyline, the most common happy ending, is this ending that happens at an incredibly young age. Sort of just as you're becoming an adult. So the fact that we don't have this in our culture on a larger scale is really troubling, and I think a problem for girls and women of all ages.
Does that again come from the people who are making the decisions think this and believe it despite evidence to the contrary? Or isn't there enough evidence to persuade them to change their minds?
I think there is enough evidence, but I don't think that they're persuaded by evidence. I mean, you know, it's a kind of emotional reaction to things, I suppose. And we don't I think that the people making these decisions just go by their own gut and their own instincts, and the idea of like this is what people want to see, and this is what people don't want to see. It very much comes down to their own personal preference, and so we have a real, it's unspoken a lot of times, but it's real, and it's kind of what ends up coming out into the culture.
Who's bucking the trend on that?
There are some, like, I recently read that Ryan Murphy was going to have an initiative to have half of his directors and writers be female. Paul Feig, you know, has famously bucked that trend. They get a lot of pushback. Paul Feig certainly did for the Ghostbusters reboot. Mm-hmm. And that's where you kind of see the forces that they're up against.
So the Ghostbusters reboot was... evidence for, which did not succeed very well, right? It was an all-female cast. Mm-hmm. Didn't sell a lot of tickets, or am I wrong about that?
I don't think that it did as well as they hoped, but I feel like, you know, that can't always be the only measure. I think that it was just met with so much... like it was seen as something controversial just to have this comedy starring a group of women who were friends and who were pursuing this this goal together. And honestly, like, I feel like it was an enjoyable movie, and it should be okay for a movie starring women to be a pretty good movie and a pretty successful movie and not have to carry the weight of like all the success of all female led movies,
and
you know,
ever. Yeah.
Forever. It's like how many mediocre movies come out every single week?
Exactly.
No one talks about that in terms of, you know, can men make movies?
Yeah.
It's just another mediocre movie. I don't personally think that Ghostbusters was a mediocre movie. I loved it. I thought it was great. My daughter also was obsessed with it. A lot of little girls loved it because they hadn't seen themselves, as in Wonder Woman, in these kind of active roles. And in this case, they weren't, you know, beautiful and wearing bathing suits. They were like wearing coveralls and weird goggles. So I think that that is important to see. And the fact that there was pushback on that came out of a certain, you know, the same kinds of forces that we're seeing pushing back on anybody else having rights or representation in our society.
From Twitter here, Hungry Traveler says, please remember that women aren't a monolith. Most of the women on screens are wealthier white women. People of color, natives, homeless, etc., are ignored. That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers bear out like that of the, you know, of the women, the percentage of women on screen, they're limited by age. And then, of course, they're limited by race. They're limited by ability, sexuality. So it gets smaller and smaller. It's definitely for women of color or of different abilities or of different sexual orientations. So it's a problem across the board, but it certainly gets even worse.
Call here from Deborah in Minneapolis. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I think excluding women in the film industry is just another version of the clubhouse when we were kids with the sign, no girls allowed. And I think it's the same in academia, government, the corporate world. And I think men are afraid if we pull the curtain back, we're going to see that what they're doing a lot of times is ridiculous, sexist, violent, not that important or not that difficult.
You know, Deborah, I also think that it's perceived as a zero-sum gain. If we give them, or we make room, I should say, for that, then we lose something. And that kind of thinking is so prevalent in other parts of our culture, including the way I think we see immigration and refugees and making places in our communities for that. Karina, what are your thoughts on this?
I agree with both of those things. I think at the top and the people that are making the decisions, it is a clubhouse, and it is exactly what Deborah describes. I think that it is about just validating their own worldview, and sort of the people that get hired are people that are, you know, remind them of them. It's the sort of implicit bias thing. It's a system that just is self-perpetuating. Right. And I do also think that in the fan world or on the internet, there is that sort of zero-sum feeling. It's the kind of thing that allowed for that weird blowback against Ghostbusters before it even came out. For about a year, people attacked it without having even seen it. And that I think is more related to this zero-sum idea of like, if other people can do it, then I can't do it, or something's being taken away from me.
Well, Karina, think about how this plays out in the tech world, particularly in the video gaming industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about what women in that part of the industry have said about how strongly repelled, I guess, they are from trying to enter into video gaming work, or, you know, into the what happens at conferences. Now that I think about this, the entertainment world is not all that unique when it comes to this.
Oh, it absolutely isn't. I mean, I mentioned it before, but I think that anywhere where there's money, power, influence, you're going to see this. You see it in tech. You see it in finance. You see it in government. You see it in entertainment and media. It's really everywhere. And I think that this is the thing we don't talk about. I mean, I remember, sort of constantly reading, going through a phase where I was constantly reading articles in the New York Times about, like, women in science face discrimination, women in finance face discrimination, and no one was ever sort of putting it together and saying, well, this is rampant.
Karina Shikano is with us. If you've just joined the conversation, we're talking about her new collection of essays called You Play the Girl, and how this issue of sexism and inertia plays out in the entertainment world, but of course noting that we'll find this in a lot of other parts of our culture as well. I'm asking you, since we started talking about Hollywood and entertainment, whether you think Hollywood has kept up with how we women around the world are changing, who we are. As noted from our tweet here, we're not monolithic, who we are and all of our different shades and life experiences. And do you think Hollywood honors and reflects back our experiences and empowerment? I think the answer to that is no, but I'd like to hear you. I'd like to hear you weigh in on that via calls and tweets. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. And Karina, I mean, it sounds like the answer for you is no, right? It does not reflect back to us.
No, I don't think that it does at all. And it's interesting. Another thing that plays into it is that the people that that create these images, for the most part, are still operating in this with this idea of, like, you know, this old-fashioned idea that probably comes from the 19th century about the idea of woman. And woman, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, well, white women aren't monolithic, and that's absolutely true. But I think that it goes beyond, it's not just a demographic is being represented, it's an idea that's being represented. And the idea is, you know, the idea of woman. And so she's, this idea, which doesn't represent the world that we live in, is an ideal, you know, media creation. And that figment, that, you know, that creation is white, young, thin, beautiful, you know, compliant, submissive, nice, you know, all these
important words there, compliant and submissive. Yeah.
Yeah.
This really fits with an interview that I was reading a while back from Salma Hayek about aging. I think she was talking to The Guardian, and she said, just what you just said about the ideal. She said, the amount of pressure on women now, it's crazy. You have to be much better than your male colleagues just so you can maybe try and get the same salary as them. And you still have to be a good wife and mother. And now you also have to be skinny, and you have to look 20 when you're 40. It's too much. We need to stop with the crazy expectations. Give ourselves a break. See, I feel like a lot of women in influential positions like Salma Hayek are speaking out around this. It's just that you don't see the barriers cracking much.
Right. People are speaking out. And I do think that there's a huge disconnect between how people feel and the kinds of things that get made. It's great that people are speaking out, though, because I think that even 5-6 years ago, people were warned against speaking out and were afraid to, and it could have a real impact on careers. But tons of people are now, and hopefully there's enough critical mass for it to make some kind of a difference.
Call here from Dakota in Fridley. Hey, Dakota, hi.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question for Karina?
So I'm just kind of curious, maybe on Karina's input, if she thinks that, could there maybe be a generational influence with people that are in authority, maybe in the business or corporate world, and could maybe they be creating a type of demographic that has a systemic influence on this continuation of how women are treated, whether in the workplace or even in media with objectification and things like that?
I am certainly hopeful that that will be the case. But I have to say, I was also hopeful of that when I was in my 20s. And maybe it's that, you know, my generation was smaller and therefore didn't have the kind of impact that this generation has. But I think there's also a danger of, like, if the system doesn't really significantly change, then people that are brought into the system are sort of forced to adapt to the system. And this is just kind of the way that it works over time. I think that all generations think that these ideas, you know, about equality and inclusion are new, but they're not that new. And, you know, I like in my research and reading, I was sort of surprised to discover that Katharine Hepburn, you know, felt that, you know, her mother was a feminist and a suffragist and fought for reproductive rights. So Katharine Hepburn felt like, well, that work is done. I don't need to fight for this. I can just put on pants and do what I want. So she was born before, you know, my grandmother was, I think. So it, you know, when we're young, we have this idea, and especially since men and women sort of enter the workforce, you know, we leave film schools and other schools in equal numbers. We enter the workforce in our 20s, kind of in equal numbers, and then the women start to drop out. And the story has been, at least throughout my adult life, oh, women choose to drop out. They choose to drop out. And no one addresses the systemic problems, like that, you know, women aren't promoted in the same way, they're paid less, they're pushed out, there's a penalty for having children for women, whereas there's a kind of reward for having children for men. And all these things contribute. There's no, you know, not a lot of societal like help for women with young children. So all these things contribute to a kind of pushing out of women from more powerful positions.
You know, Karina, I really appreciate what you wrote about the princess obsession and how Disney sees femininity. Those essays have stayed with me since I read them. And it reminded me of a conversation I had with Peggy Ornstein, whom you also quote, I think, in mm-hmm. one of your essays, about where she really sees the danger of letting your girl obsess over princesses. So here's how she put it.
You know, I think, Carrie, when you have that little girl and you hold her in your arms, you think there's nothing you want her to have to do because she's a girl. There's nothing you want her not to be able to do because she's a girl. And then she hit preschool. And it was like how the mighty fall, right? And within 2 weeks, she had come home and she had memorized all the names and gown colors of the Disney princesses. And it's so all-consuming. It's like they have ice cream every day.
You mean the culture around princesses?
I availed myself of my mom's cast-off tiara now and again when I was a child. But there was not 3 straight years where I was supposed to not only pretend to be a princess exclusively, but be addressed as one. And you have to also look at what the track is that puts little girls on, because the marketing to children is so incredibly intense. And from the get-go, it's telling little girls that how they look is more important than who they are.
Does that fit with what you believe too, Karina?
Absolutely. I mean, 100% what she said. I think that's so true. When I was little, we had the first original 3 princesses, and I liked those characters, and I watched those films, and I think I maybe went as a princess for one Halloween, but we had to make my gown. And, you know, you couldn't buy a princess gown. And now, of course, like my daughter did the same thing, hit preschool and didn't take off her princess gowns for 3 years and wore nothing else and had like 20 of them.
Well, but you felt ambivalent about that, right? I mean, that's what I got from your essays.
I felt that she, you know, the one thing I will say about it is that I think that it's a phase that kids grow out of. And what's really fascinating to me is that now my daughter's 9 and she's full tomboy, kind of, you know, wears only shorts and T-shirts. And it's hard to get her to wear a dress. And I think that what I've learned from this is that, you know, 2 things. I do think marketing is very intense, and I think it reaches kids more than we realize. It's just all around us. And it's happening at a time when they're very young and they're forming their gender identity somewhat. Like a girl might say, oh, this is a girl thing. I'm a girl, therefore I'm going to like full on identify with, you know, take this on big time, because toddlers aren't that subtle or sophisticated. So, and then they grow out of it and they go, oh, that's baby stuff. So the girly stuff becomes baby stuff. It's uncool. It's babyish. It's, you know, not as important or not as admirable as like the quote unquote boy stuff. And that's something that does kind of start to happen. So you also get a sense of how femininity is cast in the culture as silly.
Okay, so this paragraph, I just want to read this from this essay because I want all of our parents and women and men who are raising daughters out there to hear this. Here's what you say about Disney's version of femininity. Boy, this is right on. The highly processed femininity is fascinating because it's so obviously fake and put on. Yet it's precisely this unabashedly artificial, performed femininity of Disney princesses that adults don't like and little girls love. It's like candy. The more artificial, fantastical, exaggerated, and abstracted, the better. Oh, Karina, so well said. let me grab a call here from Kathy in La Crescent. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you very much. Just very quickly, I wanted to point out, drawing on a point you made a little bit earlier, Carrie, regarding women of a certain age and the popularity of Grayson, the show Grace and Frankie. You've got two incredibly smart, incredibly strong, gorgeous women of a certain age.
Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, right?
Yes, yes. And one of the shows in particular, they're all fabulous, but one in particular, a thread that they're using that I adore is their whole new business about making a vibrator for whips that
right.
comfortably in an arthritic hand.
That's right.
I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it must have been to get that made.
Yeah.
And on screen. So I will leave it at that. I know
Good.
You're short on time.
That's an excellent observation. So Kathy makes a great point, Karina. There are exceptions to what has been a pretty depressing rule here that we've been talking about. And I think they're bright spots. How much do they lead the way and create change? Or are they, as I say, exceptions?
No, I think that there are a lot of bright spots. And actually, it all kind of fits together, I think, because that's I believe it's a Netflix show. Am I right?
Yeah, I think so.
And it is, I think that the fact that we've had such a proliferation of platforms and channels, and that television has changed so much, and that it's not in the same sort of narrow funnel that it was for so many years, has exploded the types of representations that we're seeing in television. Television has changed a lot. I mean, I find myself sort of no longer watching any network television.
Same here.
And just downloading shows like that. And the shows that show women in all... I especially love women-led shows. And it's just what I'm naturally attracted to.
Same here, yeah.
Just because they're stories that I can relate to. And it's just, I get hooked into them. They're funny to me because I recognize my experience. You know, humor is about recognition, right? So if I don't see myself or anything that reflects me, then the film isn't really funny to me because it just feels like, what are those aliens doing? So I feel like, you know, that's a good example of, you know, of a show like that. But there are many, many on TV right now.
So I reached the end of the book. And a surprise awaited me, and that is a photograph of your great-grandmother, Rosa Maria Montenegro de la Fuente, taken in Peru in 1906. First, thank you for putting that there. And why is she there?
You know, she's there because I had this Alice in Wonderland theme throughout the book, and I had this picture of my great-grandmother that I thought was hilarious because she's this little girl with a really fierce expression on her face. She looks really pissed off, and she's dressed in the full Victorian, you know, like this big lacy dress with these like white button-up booties and this bow in her hair. She's dressed a lot like pictures of Alice in Wonderland, and I just was struck by the contrast between the frilly white fancy dress and her pissed off expression that I thought was really funny. Like, you know, because my book is a lot about the stories that we get sort of constrained by and shoved into, and the constrictions and the constraints, you know. And here you had this little girl, I think she was five at the time, in the most absurdly limiting and constraining outfit, and she just doesn't look happy about it.
Well, okay, so, you know, having noted your Alice in Wonderland theme, when I got to the photograph, I said, so this is who Karina is. This is one of the strong women that made Karina who she is. Karina, thank you. This is so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Karina Shikano's book is called You Play the Girl, and you can read about it on the thread.